release for that band. And it's also our Fun Drive show. So if you're listening next week, we have some special thank you gifts to send out to all of you for donating during the show. Stay tuned for All Souls Forum coming up next right here on 90.1 FM and ArtSpeak Radio coming up later on tonight at 6 o'clock. We're on the web at WednesdayMiddayMedley.org and Facebook.com. Thank you all so much for listening.
The party's over now, the dawn is drawing very nigh. Let's creep away from the day, and allow me to say goodbye.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features L. Randall Ray, and we're going to talk economics, modern money theory. And while that may not sound like the most exciting topic, I guarantee you, you will learn something from this week's show. This program was recorded on Sunday, May the 4th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We will have our usual format for today's show. We'll have the talk for about 35 minutes or so. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and we'll hear questions from the audience for Professor Ray. Let's go to the introduction. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
We live in interesting economic times, and I guess the great financial crisis of 2007 and 2008 and the fallout that came afterwards really challenged a lot of people's assumptions on how markets work and whether they're efficient or whether housing prices always go up. And we were introduced to all kinds of new concepts like CDOs and CDSs and shadow banking and quantitative easing. And since then, I've been struggling, just me personally really, to understand from a citizen's point of view what we really need to understand about economics and what really happened. And I think I found a big piece of that, or maybe the whole piece, with modern money theory. And today we have one of the founding members of the modern money theory school, MMT for short, Professor L. Randall Ray. He actually literally wrote the book on MMT. Right here, it's titled Modern Money Theory, A Primer on Macroeconomics for Sovereign Monetary Systems. This makes him an expert on fiscal policy, or rather, I guess, how money works. And Randall Ray is a professor of economics at UMKC and a senior scholar at the Levy Economic Institute. He also contributes to the official MMT blog, Macroeconomic Perspectives, or I'm sorry, NewEconomicPerspectives.org. Please welcome Randall Ray.
Well, thanks for coming out. Let's do the quiz at the beginning rather than the end. So all the questions are true or false. None of them are opinion. They're all just clear statements. There is a right answer and a wrong answer. Just like a household, the government has to finance its spending. True or false? The role of taxes is to provide finance for government spending. True or false? The federal government borrows money from the private sector to finance the budget deficit, which allows it to avoid the inflationary effects of printing money. True or false? By running budget surpluses, the government takes pressure off interest rates because more funds are then available for private sector investment projects. True or false? Persistent budget deficits will burden future generations with inflation and higher taxes. Running budget surpluses now will help build up the funds necessary to cope with the demands of the aging population, the baby boomer retirees, that they will place on health and personal care services in the coming years. True or false? Okay, some people got a lot of them right. They're all false. Okay, none of these statements is true for a government that issues its own currency. Okay, and that is what we mean by a sovereign currency, a government that issues its own currency. None of these things apply. They might apply to households. They might apply to the city of Kansas City. They do not apply to Uncle Sam. What are the constraints? We would like to get to full employment. The Fed has done everything it possibly could do. I have a Ford Foundation project. We've looked at what the Fed did. The Fed lent and spent $29 trillion, and it will spend or lend some more. We think it did more than it should have done. Okay, now it's up to fiscal policy, and Bernanke kept saying this, is now up to fiscal policy. But the problem is Uncle Sam ran out of money. This is what President Obama tells us all the time. And then people also have said, well, we could become the next Greece if we spent some more. Okay. But is any of that true? So Mark Twain, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so. It just isn't true. Uncle Sam is not broke. Here's the St. Louis Fed, which if any of you studied economics or you follow the Fed, you know that St. Louis Fed is the home to Milton Friedman. Okay? This is the far, not the farthest right, but a far right-wing branch of the Fed, which is monetarist, okay, followers of Milton Friedman. Here's what the St. Louis Fed says. As a sole manufacturer of dollars whose debt is denominated in dollars, the U.S. government can never become insolvent, i.e. unable to pay its bills. In this sense, the government is not dependent on credit markets to remain operational. Moreover, there will always be a market for U.S. government debt at home because the U.S. government has the only means of creating risk-free dollar-denominated assets. Let me just translate into plain English. The government can never run out of dollars. It can never be forced to default. It can never be forced to miss a payment. It is never subject to the whims of the so-called bond vigilantes. This is the St. Louis Fed. Here's Chairman Bernanke. He was asked on television, but also at in Congress, he gave the same answer. You know, where is the Fed getting all this money that it is spending and lending, $29 trillion and counting? He said, it's not tax money. We simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account at the banks. It's a keystroke, that's all it is. Now, he was talking about the Fed, but the same is true for the Treasury. The Treasury spends in exactly the same way, keystrokes. As long as you have someone in government with at least one index finger, you can always keystroke, okay? And if we can do $29 trillion to bail out Wall Street, we certainly could do $1 trillion to create jobs. We can't run out of money. Uncle Sam has a money tree. Or, I always say, a magic porridge pot. And if you remember the story that you read to your kids, you can't run out of porridge. He's got the magic porridge pot. We do face potential problems. If we spent too much, we could get beyond full employment resources, and that could cause inflation. Are we anywhere near there today? Okay, only absolutely, completely nutty people believe that we're close to inflation. And there are a few of those, but no serious people believe that we are close to inflation. There's no evidence that we're in danger of becoming the next Weimar Republic or Zimbabwe. Is the debt at a historic high? Is government spending out of control? Have we hocked ourselves to China? Does the debt burden our grandkids, and will those unfunded entitlements bankrupt grandkids? No. The answer to all of those questions is no. Let me just very quickly give you some data. If you look back at the federal government debt to GDP, so this is a measure of government debt to the size of our economy, you can see it was much higher in the 1950s. What were the 1950s to about 1970 called? The golden age of U.S. economic history. Okay, we started with the highest debt ratio the U.S. had ever had. Okay, we grew rapidly, and the debt ratio came down. That's exactly what will happen again if we start growing again. Why did the deficit explode to about $1 trillion at the peak, about 10% of GDP, which led to a growth of debt? In World War II, it was because we were fighting the war. Okay, this time around, it's because tax revenue collapsed. We had the deepest recession since the Great Depression. Tax revenue collapsed. You can see tax receipts just falling off a cliff. That's why Obama got a big budget deficit. It was not due to spending. The only part of spending that increases transfer payments, things like unemployment compensation, because we had a rotten economy. It wasn't because the government was going out and discretionarily increasing its spending to try to get us out of the recession, which it should have done, but it wasn't doing it. If you compare post-recession recoveries in the past, the government always led the way. This time it is not. Okay, here we are. Government spending is actually down. Compare by presidents. Obama's spending is the only one that is negative, okay, over his whole term, per capita growth. Okay, funny thing here, right? Who are the big government spenders? The Republicans, consistently, right? Reagan, big government spender. And finally, here's government job growth. Okay, the only period with actually negative government job growth. Okay, that's why the economy is rotten. Let's turn to this fear that the Chinese are going to take over because we hawked ourselves to the Chinese. If you think back 10 years ago, the fear was always Japan, right? If you look at the bottom here, the light blue, that's Japanese holdings. You can see they used to be dominant. Did the Japanese end up owning the United States and telling us what to do? If so, I missed that part. It never happened, right? It never happened. It's not going to happen with the Chinese either. Okay, it is true the Chinese, the dark blue, are increasing their holdings relative to everybody else. Japanese are decreasing relative to the Chinese. What determines external holding of U.S. government debt? It's actually, I'm sorry, this is a little complicated. It is our current account deficit. It's the trade deficit that determines it. In the old days, our trade deficit was with Japan. So Japan accumulated U.S. treasuries. Now our trade deficit is with China. So China is accumulating U.S. treasuries. Okay. As long as China wants to export to us, they're going to accumulate U.S. treasuries. Doesn't mean they're controlling us. Okay. They want to sell stuff to us. In a way, we're controlling them. Okay. We are the demand that they want. Someday that's going to turn around, and another country, maybe Vietnam, is going to replace China as the country that exports to the U.S. and accumulates U.S. treasuries. Okay, it's just the other side of the coin of a current account deficit. That's all it is. Nothing to be scared about. Well, what about the long run? The budget deficit is already falling. Okay, it's down to about 4% of GDP. Okay. As tax revenues start recovering, the budget deficit shrinks, and we stop adding to government debt. Now, some claim that the problem is this long-term, infinite horizon, unfunded entitlements. The way that they, just think about this for a second, the way they calculate this is they take a projection of government spending, which will be going up for Social Security, okay, retirees, and of tax revenue. They don't project this for a year, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years. Infinite number of years. Then discount it back to the present, they come up with a number. Oh no, the government is $200 trillion short. Okay, if this makes any sense to you as a useful occupation, okay, then I guess you can go into mainstream economics. Okay, it's absolutely stupid. Can any of you imagine what life will be like an infinite number of years from now? Okay. There probably won't be any human life anyway. It's a silly thing to do. Remember Clinton. Clinton went on TV. We have a U.S. federal government budget surplus for the first time since 1929. Remember the date. There is an important connection there. We had 6 budget surpluses in U.S. history, every one followed by a depression. Every one, 6 for 6. We're now close to 7 for 7. Okay, so Clinton has a budget surplus, goes on TV, projected the budget surplus to last for 15 years, and all the government debt was going to be retired. I hope you all remember him appearing on TV and saying this. How long did it last? 2 years. And we went back to a budget deficit. I'm just saying, it's stupid to project long into the future. Because as the economy changes, the budget situation of the government changes. Okay. What happened was that private debt exploded, as the other side of the coin of the U.S. government budget going into a surplus. There's a connection, and this gets slightly technical, but at the aggregate level, it has to be true. The private sector's balance, plus the government sector's balance, plus the foreign sector's balance. That's why we call it a balance. Okay? In the aggregate, it has to balance. This is day one, economics 101. Back when Clinton was announcing budget surpluses forever, there's a Wall Street Journal issue, 1999. You can't read it, I'll just explain. On the left-hand side, it says, the budget surpluses are going to wipe out the government debt. Isn't it great that the government has finally got its fiscal house in order and is running a budget surplus so we can get rid of all the debt? Right-hand side, the private U.S. private sector, for the first time since 1929, is running a huge budget deficit. Two columns. It's terrible what the private sector is doing. It's great what the government sector is doing. There's no, and they even have a nice chart that shows the two in the middle, and neither column talks about the other one. It's an identity. It must be true. If the government is running a surplus, the private sector will be running a deficit. It's the other side of the coin. It would be impossible to have a different outcome in the case of the United States. Okay? And the reason is this. I'm going to skip this real quickly because I'll show you a picture instead. Okay, these are the financial balances at the aggregate level. The internal financial balance, private sector and government sector, has to equal the external balance, the foreign sector, okay? But this one works better. You will note it's a mirror image. I ask my students, almost everyone can see, oh, yeah, it's a mirror image. Wow, it's a balance. Okay, for every positive, there's a negative. It balances at zero. The red is the government sector. Uncle Sam almost always runs a budget deficit, so he's negative. He's in the red. Okay. The blue is the private sector. Isn't that great? The private sector almost always runs a surplus. The private sector saves. Of course it does. If Uncle Sam runs a deficit, the private sector gets to save. Now, the green is the offsetting. Otherwise, these two sectors would exactly balance each other. But we have a foreign sector, too. And since Ronald Reagan, the U.S. has always run a current account deficit. That is, it's not quite the same, but a trade deficit. Okay? So the green is the balancing item. Without that trade deficit, it would be true that the government sector surplus, dollar for dollar, would equal our domestic private sector savings. Okay? So anyway, you can see the Clinton years were very bizarre. You can see the little tiny red above zero. That is the Clinton surplus. But look at the blue. For the first time since 1929, the U.S. private sector is running huge budget deficits. American households were spending $1.06 for every dollar of income. Okay? We collapsed into the Bush recession, but we did it again until 2006, and the whole economy collapsed. When the private sector said, we have to stop borrowing. Private sector deficits are extremely dangerous. Government sector deficits of a sovereign currency issue are not dangerous. Accounting for the government deficit. The government purchases goods and services and makes transfers by crediting accounts. Those are Bernanke's keystrokes. That's how we do it. The non-government sector pays taxes, which leads to a debit of their accounts. It's a reverse keystroke. Uncle Sam debits your bank account. And literally, lots of Americans now pay their taxes online. So that's all it is. It's a keystroke that takes the money out of your account. That's all. When government spending is greater than taxes, we call it a deficit. But the government deficit is the non-government sector's surplus. It means Uncle Sam credited more accounts than he debited. That's what a deficit means. So that surplus is an accumulation of claims on Uncle Sam. We like to have claims on Uncle Sam. You like to have green pieces of paper in your wallet. You like to have credits in your bank account. You like to own U.S. Treasury bonds, the safest assets in the world. And the rest of the world likes to hold those things too. So a government debt equals non-government net financial wealth. That clock on Times Square, the national debt, it should have said the national financial wealth. That's what it is. Okay? Uncle Sam owes us. That's good. We want Uncle Sam to owe us. Here's Frank Newman. He was the assistant treasury secretary. He says, the treasury can always raise money by issuing securities. The bond vigilantes really have it backwards. There's always more demand for treasuries. So the unlucky people don't get the treasuries. They end up with just a bank account. The lucky ones get the treasuries. Okay? Here's Lord Adair Turner in the UK. Okay, he says, I accept entirely that this is a very dangerous thing to let out of the bag. We don't want people to know this. Okay? It's medicine in small quantities, but a poison in large quantities. But there exist some circumstances in which it's appropriate to take the risk. In other words, for the government to spend more with keystrokes. Here is Paul Samuelson, in some ways, you know, the most important American economist. He literally wrote the textbooks. He says, I won't read the whole thing. It's superstition that the budget has to be balanced. We use old-fashioned religion to scare people by sometimes what might be regarded as myths into behaving in a way that the long-run civilized life requires. So this fear about budget deficits and about government debt, it's a superstition, it's a myth, it's old-time religion that economists and policymakers are perpetrating on the public. We don't want them to know the truth. Okay? So it's a necessary superstition. What is the truth? Okay. Well, I think that economists should tell the truth. There are no financial limits on a sovereign government. The government spends by crediting bank accounts. It taxes by debiting them. And a deficit means net credits. That's all it is. You can think of money as scorekeeping. Here is, it happens to be, what, Tampa Bay and Boston, but of course every ballpark has this. They've got a scorekeeper. Can the scorekeeper ever run out of runs? No, they can't run out of runs. Uncle Sam can't run out of runs either. Okay, when I say this stuff, that federal government just spends through keystrokes at credit bank accounts, and so it can afford anything that's for sale in dollars, then the reaction you typically goes through these four stages. First, you know, that's got to be crazy. Second, oh, you're going to cause Zimbabwean hyperinflation here. Third, you're going to destroy our economy. And then fourth, they get really mad, you're a dirty pink okami. Okay? And all we've done is describe the way things work. That's all. So far, I didn't give you any policy recommendations. I just described the way it actually works. St. Louis Fed understands this. Bernanke understands it. Okay. Paul Samuelson understood it in the 60s. Everyone who deals with this stuff understands it completely. So they get mad because you're telling the truth. Okay? Once you know the truth, then you take the next step. Okay, Uncle Sam can't run out of money. Now we can decide what kinds of policies to implement. Okay, without the superstition that, oh, if we don't do this right, Uncle Sam will go broke. Or the bond markets will react against Uncle Sam. Okay, this can't happen. Okay, moving to policy. Abba Lerner, who actually taught at UMKC in the 40s, came up with what he called the principles of functional finance as opposed to sound finance. Sound finance is wrong. You can't apply principles of sound finance that are sound for households to the government. They're not. It's not sound to tell the government you need to balance your budget. That's not sound finance. He said we need functional finance, finance that serves a public purpose. Okay, first, the government should spend more if there's unemployment. Do we see any unemployment in the United States? If so, Uncle Sam needs to spend more. Government should supply more money, reserves, if interest rates are too high. Okay, well, this is what Bernanke's been doing, arguably too much of it, because we got to just about zero interest rates, you know, $20 trillion ago, and he's still spending and lending more and more and more. So what Lerner is saying, the budgetary outcome, the debt outcome should never be a primary consideration. Let's focus on things that matter. okay, like employment and whether the interest rate is low enough. You know that Japan has now been in about a 28-year recession. There's a danger that we're headed on the same path because we're not doing enough to end the recession. Japan had rapid growth in the 1980s. Americans all knew that. They all pointed to Japan. What they didn't realize was that it was largely driven by the government sector. Japan had the biggest budget deficits in the world and a very healthy economy. Okay? But they had a massive real estate boom. That sounds familiar. Okay, we just went through one. Their government budget moved to surplus. That sounds familiar too. And then the economy collapsed. Okay, and they haven't been able to get it going again. They will try a small stimulus package, then they always worry about the deficit. And they raise taxes. Okay, they just raised taxes again. And so they've been, you know, stumbling along without much fiscal policy and using interest rate policy, very similar to Bernanke's interest rate policy. I'll just show you some pictures that show Japan and the U.S. Okay, here is our housing boom and prices rising and then collapsing. Okay, so here we are. Japan has been on a long-term path. You can see price changes are actually below zero. Prices are falling in Japan. That might sound like a good thing, but it's about the worst thing that can happen to an economy. That's what happened to us in the 30s. When farm output prices collapsed, farmers lost their farms. Okay? That sort of thing is going on in Japan now. So far, we're following their path. We're not negative yet, but we have extremely low inflation. Here's the budget deficits. There are two ways to get a budget deficit. One is the good way. That's what Japan was doing in the 80s. The other is the bad way. Your economy is so rotten that tax revenues collapse, and that gives you a big budget deficit. That's where we were. And finally, here is Japan's interest rate policy. Zero interest rates now for 20 years. Hasn't worked. Here we are. We got to zero quicker than they did, but we're following the same path. And if you just rely on monetary policy, we're never going to recover. Some people say, well, hold it a second. Look at Euroland. We don't want to become like Euroland. We can't become like Euroland. We're nothing like European countries. The European countries gave up their own currencies. Italy had the lira and had no problem with budget deficits of 10% of GDP. No problem at all. Okay? Year after year. They joined the euro. They gave up their own currency. They became like Missouri or Louisiana. You can pick your choice. Greece, sort of like Louisiana, right? Okay. We're not like that. We have our own currency. We have the dollar. And we have Uncle Sam. When the recession and the global financial crisis hit, we didn't rely on Louisiana to bail out its own banks. We didn't rely on Louisiana to cover unemployment compensation and all other kinds of transfer payments on its own. That's what happens in Europe. The individual countries were responsible for their own banks. They had to bail them out. Ireland actually was running a budget surplus. Crisis hit, and they have a huge government debt because the banks are 10 times the size of the country, and they had to bail them out on their own. In the United States, Uncle Sam, Ben Bernanke did the bailouts. We didn't ask individual states. So we can't become like Greece. Okay, conclusion. The currency issuing government spends by crediting accounts, taxes by debiting them. It can always afford to spend more. The issues are, is it going to be inflationary? Might it affect the exchange rate? Will it have interest rate effects? Okay, we can talk about all of these and reduce the fears about them. Beyond full employment, sure, increasing government spending is going to be inflationary, but we're nowhere near that. Sovereign currency gives more policy space. There's no default risk of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam can always control the interest rates, no matter the size of the budget deficit. If we want zero interest rates, we can have them. That's what Bernanke proved. That's what Japan has proved for 20 years with the biggest budget deficits in the world. And you can use policy to achieve full employment. Okay, we can always do that if we want to. Fine, let me just close with the things I didn't say because people a lot of times hear things I never said. Okay. First, I did say sovereign government faces no financial constraints, cannot become insolvent in its own non-convertible currency. That just means the U.S. government doesn't promise to convert dollars to yen or to euros at a fixed exchange rate. We let it float, okay? If you adopt a gold standard or if you peg to another currency, that limits your domestic policy space. But we don't do that. The government can only buy what's for sale, okay? But if anything is for sale in dollars, the U.S. government can buy it. I did not say government ought to buy everything. That would be a really bad idea, because it wouldn't leave enough for the private purpose. We want the government to serve the public purpose, but we want it to leave room for the private purpose too. The size of the government is mostly a political decision. It has some economic implications. If you look around the world at capitalist economies, the size of the national government varies from a low of about 20%, that's where the U.S. and Japan are, to a high of about 50%. That's where France is. And capitalism seems to work within those constraints. Where you want it to be is a political decision. Okay? In the U.S., we tend to like a smaller government than the French do. Fine. I didn't say that deficits can't be inflationary. Deficits that are too big can be inflationary. But again, we're nowhere near there. And Japan, with a government debt outstanding that is 250% of GDP, their deficit is still too small. How do we know? Unemployment and no economic growth and prices falling. I didn't say that deficits can't affect exchange rates. They might, although Greenspan admitted no economist has a theory or model that actually is able to predict exchange rate movements based on anything. Okay? We don't know, because they're largely determined by financial markets. Sovereign governments let their currency float, and float means the currency can go up and down. You can try to intervene, or you can just let them go. Okay, thanks. This is a copy of the book that Doug held up. Thank you.
You're listening to L. Randall Ray talking about economics here on today's All Souls Forum. We're going to take a short break. We owe you some messages. We're going to do a couple of minutes of those, and then we'll be back with the question and answer portion of our program for today.
Does the theory that you've just given explain why Switzerland's currency is so strong compared to everything else?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's unique to my theory. Look, there are a lot of people in the world who are engaged in questionable activity, including illegal activities. And Switzerland welcomes their accounts. Your alternative is bitcoins. Okay, so I think that that's why. I mean, they safeguard your account no matter who you are. And there's an awful lot of illegal activity in the world.
I'm wondering if other countries with similar demographics and sovereign currencies like New Zealand, Australia, or Canada could try modern money theory and actually have it work.
Yeah. Okay, first, remember, all the way up to the slide on Abba Lerner and functional finance, I was describing. The description I gave applies to the United States, to New Zealand, to Australia, to the UK, to Turkey, until it joins the euro, to Japan, and on and on and on and on. Every country that issues its own currency, everything I said applies to them too. Okay? Now, let's say you're a tiny country like New Zealand, and let's say that the rest of the world isn't that interested in exporting to you because you're too tiny. Then they don't have a huge demand for the New Zealand currency. Okay? And that can limit what they can buy outside their country. So the U.S. does have an advantage. The whole world wants dollars. And remember I said you can only, Uncle Sam can only buy things that are for sale for dollars. But in Uncle Sam's case, you know, the world is, what do they say, his oyster. Everybody wants dollars. So Uncle Sam can potentially buy everything. That might not be true for a smaller country whose currency is not in demand. When Australia, you know, pension funds around the world want to diversify their portfolio. Okay. Of course, they want a lot of U.S. dollar assets, but they also want other things. At one point, a decade ago, they decided, you know, Australia looks good. Let's diversify into Australian dollar assets. They did that. Suddenly, there's a huge demand outside Australia for Australian dollars. Okay? So it can happen, and then that makes it possible to import more than you could have done before. But New Zealand, their government issues their own currency. They can always buy anything for sale in New Zealand. Okay? They might not be able to buy everything for sale in China. Okay, that depends. Yeah.
I have been getting numerous pop-ups by a gentleman on my browser telling me about this law that was passed, I guess, a couple of years ago that said basically all foreign entities have to report any American citizens' deposits and income, and that the dollar will suddenly drop in value and everything on July 1 when something comes into effect. Have you heard that, and do you know what that's all about?
I think whoever this is selling you something.
They are.
Yeah, no, just wait. It's not going to happen. Look, and, you know, furthermore, if anything bad happens in the world, what happens to the U.S. dollar? Everyone runs into the U.S., okay? Because you want to be in the safest currency. Now, people worry that the Chinese RMB is going to replace the dollar. I think that's true. But none of us here will be alive when that happens. It's going to be a very long time. The UK pound remained the international currency long after the US was a bigger economy than the UK. Okay, yeah, so it's going to be a long time, 50 years down the road or more, before the RMB becomes an important international currency. And the Chinese don't really want it, because what does it mean? When there's a global financial crisis, the Fed had to bail out the world. The Chinese aren't ready to do that, okay? When I told you the Fed spent and lent $29 trillion, I think 30%, this is a rough guess, was to bail out foreign central banks. And then of the top 12 banks the Fed had to bail out, about half of them were foreign banks. So you have a big responsibility when you're the issuer of the international reserve currency. The UK used to do that. Now we play that role. Yeah.
Okay, banks is what I'm talking about. I've just been reading a book about the last 5 years and what's happened to the banks and why they all went under and all of that and bailing them out and all. That doesn't mean our country's in good shape, does it, when that happens?
Yeah.
Or is it not in good, or is it in good shape when that happens?
I've written a lot. If you go to these websites, I could give you a talk about the crisis too another time. What has happened is the financial sector has become much too big, just like it was in 1929. In 1929, the financial institutions were doing exactly what they're doing in 2007. And I mean exactly. Get a hold of John Kenneth Galbraith's book, The Great Crash, and read it. There's a whole chapter devoted to an institution you're going to recognize, Goldman Sachs. They did exactly the same thing again that they were doing last time, and we got exactly the same result. The financial system collapsed. Last time, remember, Roosevelt came in after this had happened. Within 100 days, he solved the problem. He got rid of them. Okay, half of all the banks were shut down. Well, actually, all of them were closed temporarily, and he sent Jesse Jones in to look at the books. He demanded the resignation of all top management of all the big banks and said, we might accept you back, but you have to resign. Okay, you have to give me your letter of resignation right now. Promoted up the middle management and said, you have to stop everything you were doing. You just keep the bank open. That's it. Okay, no more loans, no more funny business, and we're going to determine whether you're worth saving or not. They decided half of them weren't worth saving. Okay, and then we had Glass-Steagall, we separated them, we put Goldman Sachs back in its place. It became irrelevant. The big investment banks that had caused the crisis became completely irrelevant. They started growing in the 70s, gradually in the 80s, a bit quicker in the 90s, and then by 1999, all of those had moved from what is called a partnership, okay, to a public entity that issued stock, and they did that because they wanted to take advantage of the stock market boom. They wanted to enrich themselves, people like Bob Rubin. Okay? So this time around, what did we do? Close them down? No. Prosecute any of the crooks? No. What did we do? Propped them up, said, go back to doing what you were doing before. And they are. Okay? They're going to crash again. We can just hope that the next president will actually do something. Because Obama won't. It's clear. Hillary won't either.
Why do we have a published and approved debt ceiling?
Yeah, really dumb idea. We're, I don't know that any other major country does this. If you think about it, it's a fairly crazy thing to do. Because so Congress and the president, you know, they approve a budget, the president signs it. And it tells them, okay, here are the programs we want you to spend on. Here's the amount we allocate. And, of course, then there are some that are a bit open-ended. All right? And so the administration starts spending the money. They can't control the tax revenue. You can project the tax revenue, but you can't control it because it depends on the performance of the economy. If the economy slows down, tax revenue won't be so high. If Wall Street slows down, tax revenue won't be so high because, unfortunately, so much of national income goes to Wall Street that you really rely on the pay of the 1% in order to drive the tax revenue. So when capital gains start declining, tax revenue falls. And so you get a budget deficit. Okay, and then when you start getting up to the budget limit, you have to get approval to raise it. That used to be routine almost all the time. Okay, now it's not routine at all because the Republicans decided that they can get a lot of publicity out of threatening not to approve it, or by getting rid of programs they hate, which is, you know, basically anything that benefits the population, by holding it hostage and saying, we won't approve the debt. So it's a crazy thing to do.
Thank you very much for this fantastic presentation. As a macroeconomist myself, I was very pleased to hear you talk all this through. Balances do balance. A couple of questions. Yes, spending lowers the interest rate, and one would think would stimulate employment, more investment, and therefore more employment. But there seems to be an effect of the myth that investors don't always just respond to the falling interest rate. All things are not always necessarily ceteris paribus. Second, why did Weimar and Zimbabwe happen? How can developed countries with open economies that do not have the key currency avoid that? And thirdly, looking forward to China and the key currency issue, I believe it's possible that China will not have to wait the 80 years that we had to wait to become the key currency after we became the world's largest economy. I believe 1872 is the marker when we became the world's largest economy. 1952 is about the time that we became the real world central currency. Looking forward to China and assuming just finish this up. Assuming that China becomes the key currency in 20 to 40 years, how would your prescriptions or your analysis change?
Okay, the interest rate investment relation is extremely weak because what matters most if you're going to invest is what you think your profits are going to be. A zero interest rate is no good if you think you're going to make losses. And so, yeah, this link is extremely weak, and when the economy is not doing well, I would say there's no link at all. There is no interest rate at which you can get people to invest if they're pessimistic about the future. I forgot the second one, but on China, the U.S. will become someday, you know, the second largest economy in the world, we will need to focus more on producing for ourselves, which is not a bad thing. Okay? Rather than importing, we'll produce for ourselves. We don't need to run the international currency reserve in order to keep us at full employment or anything like that. What we need to do is focus on producing for our own population. And unlike many countries in the world, the U.S. is a more open economy. We allow more immigrants, so as our demographics continue to move toward an aged society, our problems are not nearly as severe as, let's say, Japan, which doesn't allow immigration, and they're losing a workforce the size of Detroit or something like that every year through retirement, and they're not replacing them. The U.S. has the potential to slow down the aging process and keep productive capacity up. Sorry, I forgot what the second one was. Oh, okay. First, we know what happened to Germany. They lost World War I. It's not a good idea to lose a world war. And then the winners said, you owe us reparations payments. And John Maynard Keynes wrote a very famous book absolutely predicting what was going to happen to Germany. So their productive capacity was all devoted to exporting, because they actually had to make the payments in gold. So they had to earn gold. So they had nothing for their population to eat. Okay? And they would give them income. There's nothing to buy. So the prices increased. Zimbabwe had a civil war. Civil wars are not good for your economy either. That maybe a bad property redistribution, I don't know. I don't want to make a judgment on whether it was a bad idea. But what happened was the production of the main crops was completely wiped out. Okay, and so again, those things are not good for the economies. And none of the developed world is anything like Zimbabwe. So I don't think that there's any danger of that happening. Anyway, there are people who have written on that from this perspective.
I'd like to ask a question about the traction of clear explanation. You've made the point several times that we've seen this all before, and really smart people, you mentioned economists as a trait, have figured out how to write that down and describe it in pretty compelling detail for those who are willing to look with a fairly jaundiced eye. But I find myself thinking, following the debate amongst the economists about which economist group deserves more something about how come we weren't able to get more traction with all this theory. I wonder if there isn't a geo-financial perspective on all of this that goes beyond the numbers. And thinking about it in terms of island nations and continental nations, and perhaps the fact that America has at times thought of itself as an island with a continent before it, and at other times we seem to have thought about ourselves as an island with no more resilience than Japan. Is there anyone in the area that you're looking at who is looking at this question of pessimism from a more geographic perspective?
Well, I don't know that I can give an answer to that, but if you think about the kinds of economies we've developed in the West, an awful lot of our productive capacity has been devoted to war. And, you know, back in the 60s, economists said, you know, what we've got is military Keynesianism. And we rely on that to keep the economy pumping along. And I think if you look at the European nations and you look at Britain, I think that this has played a big role in economic growth. And we use the threat of, used to be the Soviet Union, now it's China, Korea, Middle East, whatever, as a way to justify this kind of spending, which does create jobs and creates income. And if it's big enough, it will get the economy going again. Now, the kinds of wars we've had in the recent past are not big enough to do that. The threat of China might be a big enough threat to get us going. But I think we need to find an alternative because, obviously, wars are dangerous. And China has found an alternative. The Chinese model is completely different from the European model. Okay? Now, China does fear the West, and you know that has to play a role in their strategy. But their strategy for economic development and growth is very different. It's really not based on military Keynesianism. So they found an alternative. I think we need to find one too.
You mentioned that neither Obama nor Hillary is willing to prosecute individuals on Wall Street and really confront the wrongdoers in banking and Wall Street. I've seen the heads of regulatory agencies being interviewed and asked, why hasn't anyone been prosecuted? I've seen the officials in justice being interviewed. The answer is always, they didn't do anything illegal. Could you give us your take on why people aren't being prosecuted and in what way we could have gone, someone could have gone after them?
Well, look, they haven't been investigated. You can't possibly determine that they did nothing illegal until you investigate. They haven't been investigated. You investigate, you indict, then you prosecute. Okay? None of those has been done. We've seen plenty of internal emails that sure look like criminal activity. We can trace those up. But in any case, we've got to investigate first. And, you know, unfortunately, Bill Clinton is the one who brought Wall Street over to the Democratic side. It must have something to do with money. Okay. Campaign finance. So Bill Clinton brought him in, and Obama was the early leader in Wall Street money in the campaign. And there's a political scientist named Tom Ferguson who tracks the early money. And he's demonstrated in his research it's the early money that chooses the candidate. Obama was the early candidate of Wall Street. Okay, Hillary this time will probably be the early candidate of Wall Street. It's money, and there. Now, what did Eric Holder say when he was asked, you know, why haven't you prosecuted any of these? He said, it would hurt the reputation of the bank if we found out that the top manager of the bank were criminals. Well, yeah, it probably would hurt the reputation of the bank, you know. Those banks ought to be closed down. And probably none of them would survive if they were actually investigated. My colleague is Bill Black. Probably all of you have seen him. And he, in 2004, he was saying, it's all fraud. Every single thing in the financial sector is fraud. And I had studied the saving and loan crisis, so I knew there was a lot of fraud in the saving and loan crisis. I said, Bill, I'm sure there's fraud, but it can't all be fraud. Well, by 2007, I realized Bill was absolutely right. It's all fraud. If you look at every single step in the from mortgage origination through to securitizing it and selling it, every single step was fraudulent. Every one. There probably aren't any mortgage-backed securities that aren't fraudulent, okay? The amount, the number of crimes involved here is beyond conception. So to believe that you couldn't send in teams and find criminal activity all over the place, I think is just completely delusional. Okay? The crimes are huge. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Okay, what they had done in the 20s is small potatoes compared to what they did this time.
You said that
Everybody in the world wants to have dollars. And this last go around, the Fed keystroked to the tune of $27 trillion. So what would happen if the Fed keystroked $200 trillion?
Okay. Now, we need to be clear on the difference between the Fed and the Treasury, all right? Milton Friedman used to say, the Fed flies helicopters and drops money. It actually never does that. That would be the Treasury. The Treasury can fly helicopters and drop money. We can call it Social Security payments. We can call it welfare payments, okay? That's what the Treasury does. It drops money into your account and you can go spend it. The way that the Fed operates is it either spends it by buying an asset that you have or it lends it to you against assets. Okay? It's a completely different operation. So if I've got mortgage-backed securities and the Fed offers me a price that I'm willing to take, what the Fed does is it credits my bank account and takes my treasuries. Has it changed anything? It takes the mortgage-backed securities. Has it changed anything in terms of my wealth? No. Okay, it made it more liquid. But am I more likely to now run out and spend? Probably not. All they did was change from me holding a mortgage-backed security as an asset to me holding a claim on a bank as an asset. Okay. It doesn't really change my spending behavior. And so these numbers, could it be $200 trillion? Yeah, it could, if the Fed could find $200 trillion worth of financial assets that it wants to buy. Okay? So my complaint about this number is that the Fed is allowing institutions that almost certainly were insolvent, that should have been closed down. It's actually the law of the land that banks that are insolvent must be resolved, okay? Not kept on life support at the Fed. We found that among the biggest banks, some of those were borrowing daily at the Fed for over 2 years at interest rates close to zero. Okay, and I mean really close to zero, 2 or 3 basis points, 0.01, 0.02, 0.03 interest rates. So the Fed was keeping them on life support, hoping that things would turn around. They're not supposed to do that. Okay, so I don't want to leave you with the impression that there's any danger that the $29 trillion of purchases and lending could cause a hyperinflation. Because they're not, you know, putting money into the accounts of all Americans. What they're doing is they're buying some assets, okay, to prop up the banking system. So it's completely different. If Uncle Sam had dropped through helicopters into our bank accounts $29 trillion, I'm pretty sure a lot of us would have gone out and bought something, okay? But it's not the same sort of an operation.
So what I hear is the money is going to the wealthy. Is that true? I mean, and one of the ones that aren't getting it are people that have CDs, you know, the old people. And where we have now poor people because they can't get a job, we're going to have old people that are poor because their CDs have run out and they have no money left.
Yeah. That's sort of the flaw in the thinking at the Fed. The low interest rates might not stimulate the economy at all for the reason we talked about before, because it doesn't stimulate investment, and it actually destimulates because it reduces the interest earnings, especially of older people who tend to hold most of the financial wealth in the country. It tends to be, you know, very concentrated among the elderly for fairly obvious reasons. They accumulate savings and retirement funds over their life. And so they are really hurt by very low interest rate policy that keeps them from being able to spend. So that's a problem. If you look at, so we've been in a recovery now, right, supposedly, at least for some people. If you look at all of the economic gains, 90% of all the gains have gone to the top 1%. Okay, that's why most people don't feel better, because all those gains are going to the very top.
It is. There is a book I read a few years ago that was